Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking a bit about how it is that over time, soldiers have struggled with the lasting emotional effects of war. And certainly that has been the case as long as there's been combat. Over time, people have had different names for it. They've had different ways to talk about it. But the experience has certainly not changed, and it's been with us for a very, very long time. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with a scholar from Australia. She's an historian of medicine who has looked at this issue in Australia and is interested also in how people have thought about it here in the United States, how soldiers both places have come to terms with post-war trauma. Our guest is Dr. Rosalind Herter. She, at the moment, is visiting on a Fulbright Fellowship here in the United States. She's at the in the Department of Medical History at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. She is a graduate of University of Melbourne in Australia. She got her PhD in history there, and her thesis was about the experiences of Australian medical officers who were prisoners of war of the Japanese during World War II. She's also been involved in some other interesting things. She was a member of a team that did research and writing for a government-commissioned history of Australian peacekeeping and post-Cold War operations. She was also a member of a team that worked on editing transcripts of interviews with World War II veterans as part of a national project commissioned by the Australian Department of Veterans Affairs. She also wrote and co-designed websites for the Australian War Memorial at Canberra on the Korean War and Australian military operations, and also on World War I and Australian involvement there in France. She's here visiting the campus, gave a talk, and we'll be doing another at noontime today. And we're very pleased to have her here on the program to talk with us. Questions are always welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, David.
How did you get interested in the subject?
I've always been interested in military history. I come from a big military family, and my mother's a doctor, so I'm interested in military medicine. And in doing my PhD topic, I was really interested in not only in the experience of captivity, but the post-war legacies, physical and psychological. I mean, the real measure of captivity is the decades afterwards. And the problem of ex-POWs and veterans in general of the First World War and the Second World War, Korea, not really until Vietnam, were not recognized and not addressed. And so, you know, many thousands of veterans, allied and Axis-powered veterans, suffered for decades without anyone recognizing their particular needs.
I guess that's, you know, I mentioned in the beginning, and you nodded, and certainly it's true, that trauma, psychological trauma related to combat experience, probably as long as there has been combat, people have experienced this. So that's not new.
Yeah.
Maybe what has changed over time is the way that we talk about it, the words, the terms that we have to describe it. And maybe also a big change is actually in our willingness to talk about it.
Yeah.
And the big change is that we've gone from a time when it seemed to be something that we actually didn't want to talk about. And I think that soldiers were actively discouraged from talking about
it.
To the point that we are, and, you know, we've given it a new name, and it's something that we're much more willing to talk about. I'm not sure that makes it any easier to talk about, but at least it's out more in the open than it has been.
Absolutely. I mean, going back to Crimea, going back to the American Civil War, there were terms like soldier's irritable heart, or DaCosta syndrome, or battle fatigue, or neurosis, you know, all these sort of catch-all terms that didn't really mean anything, but they were just to capture that group of soldiers that just weren't coping. And for throughout the First World War and much of the Second World War, there was attempts to find pathological causes for it, you know, like shell shock is a physiological reaction to being exposed to shells exploding. It's not anything to do with war itself. It's a physical thing. Or recent understandings of trauma, not recent, in the late 19th century were from railway accident victims, and they called it railway spine, in that, you know, when they were at railway accident, the spine was shaken up, and it led to things like sleeplessness and nightmares and you know, motor neuron problems, you know. So it's taken a long time, and it really wasn't until after the Second World War, and then not really until Vietnam, that war itself was starting to be blamed for post-war trauma, mm-hmm. you know. So it's quite fascinating. One thing that particularly interests me about America is the parallels between America and Australia with our Vietnam veterans in terms of them really bringing post-war trauma to the forefront, which really spurred the psychological and psychiatric community into actually organising classification and diagnosis for PTSD. And, of course, at the same time in the 60s and 70s, a lot of research was being done with civilian emergency personnel, with victims of sexual and physical assault, with motor accident vehicle victims, you know. So there was a lot of civilian trauma studies going on as well. But for some reason, the military acceptance of PTSD and war trauma has taken much longer than civilian. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. Probably because war trauma is very much tied up with media hysteria and litigation and financial compensation. And, of course, nobody wants to get involved with that. Mm-hmm. So,
well, talk a little bit about the way that Australian veterans have talked about this, and is it much like, you think, American veterans, and particularly, I guess we would be talking about from veterans of Vietnam, and perhaps after, but it was those guys particularly, I think, who had a need to talk about it and a willingness to talk about it that previous soldiers hadn't done. And it was not always easy on these guys, because the thing that we hear from them so often is that their fathers, their uncles, their, you know, whoever was around who had that experience, they were saying, well, you know, this is just you just suck it up, okay?
Yeah.
You know, that's just what you do. Yep. You know, you don't whine about it. You just get on with it.
Yep.
And an awful lot of pain ended up getting buried that way and not
Absolutely.
Dealt with. Because people said, well, you just forget about it. It's over now. It's
yeah, which then led to suicide and domestic violence and alcoholism.
Yeah. So how have Australian, particular Australian vets talked about this in the same way that Americans have?
Not until Vietnam, for sure. But the interesting thing about America's Vietnam experience and Australia's Vietnam experience is that they're quite different. They both the levels of PTSD that have been shown in studies of both groups are very similar, but I would argue they're for quite different reasons. The Australians, and of course Australia is a very small country, so we're only 20 million people, so it's a tiny country. We only contributed 50,000 soldiers to Vietnam, so, you know, completely different from the American experience. But what happened was that the Australians were a very highly trained force because they were, by virtue of being a small military. So they were, one of their main roles in Vietnam was to secure Phuc Thuy province, which they did, and they held it. So they came back thinking, well, we did a great job. We did our job. We weren't involved in napalm or the killing of Cambodian civilians or anything like that. And they came back to a country that had watched America's war on TV. So they were tarred with the failure of the American war of the Americans. So they came back saying, well, we were professional and we did what we were told. It didn't work out. But so there was an added layer of resentment there that they found difficult to deal with. And, of course, they were just as traumatized as the Americans. I mean, my uncle's a Vietnam veteran and he exhibits all the classic responses of the, you know, exaggerated startle response when you hear a loud bang. And for years he sat up in the middle of the night and shot a gun whenever he heard a noise, you know, things like that. But the Australian response was much, and the Australian public, I would argue, were even more anti-war than the American public. Even though Vietnam is in our region of, economics and everything, Australians couldn't understand why America was in Vietnam to start with, but they really couldn't understand why Australia was. And it was basically a strategic pact that was signed between America and Australia and New Zealand in 1951 called the ANZUS Treaty, which then led us to be involved in Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, everything. So I think the anti-war sentiment was much stronger in Australia, so they came back to that as well. So I think, and nobody wanted to talk about it, absolutely no one in Australia. You know, they just wanted to get our troops back and then forget it. I mean, the only reason the troops came back was that we had an election And the first day our new Prime Minister, Gough Whitlam, was elected, his first thing he did was withdraw the troops. And that was part of his platform.
Our guest, let me again introduce our guest, Rosalind Herder. She is from Australia. She is here in the United States and visiting a Fulbright Fellowship. She's up at University of Wisconsin-Madison there in the Department of Medical History, and that is her field, medical history. She has a PhD from University of Melbourne. And we're talking here about post-traumatic stress and perhaps over time how attitudes towards the trauma that soldiers experience being in combat, how that has changed, or at least maybe the ways that we talk about it has changed. The experience probably hasn't changed, but the way we talk about it has changed over time. And maybe make some comparisons between the experiences of Australian soldiers and American soldiers. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You talked a little bit earlier about how perhaps over time people in medicine or in social science or in the counseling professions thought about the trauma that resulted being in military combat, and also sometimes the trauma that people can experience who have been in natural disasters, in accidents, who have been physically and sexually assaulted, and how, you know, that can all kind of be In some ways, that can all be, you know, trauma is trauma, so it's kind of the same experience no matter, you know, where it comes from.
Sure.
And the fact that over time, particularly though when we're talking about war, we've thought differently about what this is all about, and we've had different terms for it, and so now we have post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. Now, and I guess I asked this question to you as a medical historian. The fact that now we have this term, we sort of have this generally accepted term. It's in the diagnostic and statistical mm-hmm. manual. Yep. You know, it's acknowledged to be a really thing, and we know what it is, and we have ways to describe it. And what does that now mean that we actually have a solid term for that? And does, I suppose, then the question is, does it make it any easier for the people who are experiencing that to actually see, no, I'm not making it up. It's not really in my mind. It's mm-hmm. a real thing, and this is it.
I think it's a double-edged sword. The fact that there is a diagnosis now means that there's a lot of criticism of veterans who come back and say they have PTSD because it's easy to get a pension, and they're just, you know, they're malingerers. They don't want to work. It's just easy to say, hey, I'm traumatized. But the thing is, like in Australia and in America, to actually be diagnosed with PTSD is a fairly rigorous process. You know, they don't just hand out pensions to anyone who says they're traumatized. You know, they actually have to go through quite a lot to have it acknowledged. And also there's very much the stigma of actually admitting to any mental illness in the military. So I think if someone actually does, it takes them quite a lot to do it. I mean, that's standard for even now. And especially like the First World War and the Second World War, where the understanding of mental illness was so poor, particularly related to war. But, you know, as you say, they came home and they were told just to forget about it. And like with POWs, for example, when they came back, their families were told not to ask them about it because it would keep reminding them. So they didn't ask about it. They didn't talk about it. And then 30, 40 years later, they all start, a lot of them having breakdowns when they retire. So it's not easy to get PTSD recognized in the military. But at the same time, it's now that there is a classification, it's so easy to criticize. You know, there are critics that say, well, it's a social construct, and you know, and also that the whole sort of there's a hierarchy of martyrdom in the military. Like the First World War veteran said to the Second World War veterans, well, you didn't go through trench warfare, you weren't shelled, don't talk to me. The Vietnam veterans came back and the World War II veterans said, oh, come on, you were there for a year. How bad could it have been? You know, and now peacekeepers are being treated like that by Vietnam veterans. And peacekeepers are the newest cohort of PTSD sufferers, which I think is fascinating. And I've done quite a lot of research on that. And that's across militaries and across nations that peacekeepers are exhibiting not as high rates as war, but, you know, most wars... studies have been done, sort of PTSD rates fall sometimes between 15% and 30%, and depending on the time lapse and everything. PTSD is around most deployments that have been studied over the past 30 years are anywhere from 2% to 15% of people will develop a stress disorder within 3 years post-deployment. So I think that's really interesting that the people who have suffered won't acknowledge the suffering of the people who come after because it's seen as more easy. And I think that's a real problem as well.
Yeah. Well, that is interesting. I suppose that people write off their first reaction would be, well, peacekeepers, they're not in a shooting war. No one's shooting at them. No one's shelling them. Why would they have PTSD?
Well, they have it for quite different reasons. And sometimes they are shot at. I mean, quite often they are and they can't respond. So one of the biggest problems with peacekeepers is their powerlessness and their feelings of ambiguity. I mean, often they are dealing with, like, for example, in Cambodia, Australians led the Cambodian peacekeeping force. We're trying to set up the country for a democratic election. So the Khmer Rouge, who'd been responsible for a genocide of 3 million Cambodians, now had to be treated as a legitimate political party, and they had to negotiate with them. You know, you can imagine. Or in Bougainville in the late 90s, the Australian forces were there, and the revolutionary forces that had been the enemy a year earlier were now guarding their camps. So the ambiguity of their role within often civil war is quite distressing, but also it's particularly for combat-trained soldiers to be put in a situation where they can't defend themselves according to the rules of engagement. They can't shoot, you know. A classic example is when Australians were in Rwanda in 1995, a group of Australian doctors and infantry were working in a refugee camp. And of Hutu refugees, about 100,000. And they were surrounded by Tutsi militia who were seeking revenge for the massacres of the Tutsis earlier. And in one day, the Australians saw 4,000 people massacred, you know, by hand with machetes. And the infantry couldn't intervene to stop anyone. I mean, kids were being killed right in front of them. The medical personnel could only try and save as many people as possible. And the fallout from that was really, really significant in terms of the feelings of complete powerlessness and helplessness when their training instincts are to intervene and save people, and they can't. And that is shown through studies to be just as traumatizing as actually being involved in a shooting war.
Do you think that we're any better equipped now to try to help people who are experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder? I mean, the fact that maybe we have a slightly better understanding of what it is and maybe better ways of talking about it, does that also mean that our tools to help them help these folks are any better?
The militaries have definitely come a long way. I mean, for example, in Australia and America, like before a deployment, personnel are given extensive sort of stress management counselling. There are often psychologists employed on a mission. When they come back, they go through rigorous psychological testing and debriefing, and they're offered counselling up to 3 or 5 years later. Their families are offered counselling. But what happens is, especially with young personnel who are still serving, to admit to a mental illness or trauma while you're serving is difficult and dangerous for your career. It still is. You know, if you're tagged as a P, which is, you know, like you get a P on your file, but it's psychologically, you know, dangerous, you're probably not going to get deployed again. You know, so they have to keep that in mind. So I think that the tools are there. If people want them, they're there. But the stigma of admitting to any problems are still so significant that a lot of people who need help aren't going to get it. And also, there's also a significant time lag. Even if people leave the services, they usually won't. These are shown, that particularly like with peacekeepers, for example, there's usually a time lag of up to 7 years before they'll actually seek help. So by that stage, their career is usually, you know, up the creek. Their partners have probably, you know, there's significant family interpersonal problems. There's usually self-medication with alcohol and drugs. So by the time they seek help after that time lapse, things are really bad.
Mm-hmm. We are almost at our midpoint here. And again, I want to encourage people who are listening, if you would like to be involved in the conversation, you certainly may by calling us at 333-9455. That's the local number here for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And again, our guest this morning is Dr. Rosalind Herter. She's an historian of medicine. She's a medical historian, and she's here visiting the campus and the folks at the U of I College of Medicine. I brought her here to the community to do some talking. She is Australian. She was educated at University of Melbourne. She got her PhD there, where she wrote her thesis on the experiences of Australian medical officers who were prisoners of war captured by the Japanese during World War II. She is here in the United States on a visiting Fulbright Fellowship, spending her time at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in the Department of Medical History. And as I've mentioned before, she's done various kinds of writing and research that have to do with the sorts of things that we're talking about here, about post-traumatic stress disorder, about some of the experiences of Australians who were prisoners of war. She wrote and co-designed websites for the Australian War Memorial in Canberra. She was involved in a project editing transcripts of interviews with Australian World War II vets as part of a national project there that was commissioned by the Department of Veterans Affairs in Australia, and also was involved in one of a team of people involved in researching and writing a history, four-volume history, commissioned by the Government of Australia of Australian peacekeeping and post-Cold War operations. Questions, comments, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'd be interested in having you talk a little bit about some of the things that you have done involving the experiences of Australians who were prisoners of war.
I've done a lot.
I know that you have done a lot in this area. And particularly, I guess, the thing that we were talking just a little bit about this before we got going, about how talking about that and thinking about that gets very complicated, at least in Australia. It gets complicated by the relationship between Australia and Japan.
Yeah, very much so. After the Second World War, and just to put in context, one quarter of all Australians who died in the Second World War were prisoners. So for a small population, that was catastrophic. Catastrophic. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of everybody knew someone who had a prisoner of war in their family, you know. So the anti-Japanese sentiment after the Second World War was much stronger in Australia, than I would argue, than in America, where the European War was always highlighted and talked about. And many more thousand Americans were in German camps than in Japanese camps. But, of course, after the Second World War, Japan was rebuilt. They became an economic giant. And by 1960, Japan was Australia's major trading partner. So the Australian government, successive governments, were very reluctant to engage in any discourse with veterans groups about compensation or even apologies. Like, for a lot of Australian veterans, they just wanted an apology from the government, which they've never got, of course. And the Japanese unwillingness to apologize or give any sort of financial compensation. And often it wasn't just financial compensation for pain and trauma and medical problems. It was actually the pay that we're supposed to receive as prisoners that the Japanese didn't give them. You know, they just wanted their pay back. So that was a big problem. But, of course, being a country in the Asia-Pacific region, Japan, you know, by the 80s was the giant, the economic giant, and we were completely it tied with them economically, strategically, in every other way, which then made it increasingly difficult for veterans to be heard and have their pain acknowledged. And even in Japan, I mean, the Japanese official history of the Second World War makes no mention of prisoners at all. And they had, you know, 200,000 Allied prisoners. So their unwillingness to even acknowledge that it happened is quite hurtful for Australian prisoners as well. And the first time a Japanese official actually apologized unofficially and mentioned prisoners of war, this was in 1989, he was shot by a Japanese veterans group. He didn't die, but he was shot, which pretty much showed the attitude towards talking about that side of the war. And, of course, the Japanese have, because of the atomic bombs, the horror of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there's very much been an attitude, particularly in the education system, that it obviates all responsibility for everything else that happened before that. So that's always been a problem as well.
Do you think that has made Australians any more vocal about the involvement of Australian troops overseas than Americans, for example, or others? I mean, how controversial when it came to Vietnam or any involvement Australians have had after that? Has there been a lot of public debate about whether it's appropriate for Australian troops to go, even if, say, they were going to be part of a peacekeeping mission and
Absolutely.
Theoretically not in a shooting war?
Absolutely. Basically since Korea. The Korean War, the Americans, because obviously after the Second World War, Great Britain was collapsed economically and every other way. And that was the first time that the Australian government sort of went, well, this was our major benefactor. We have to go to America now. So we have to set up economic and strategic ties with America. So that means we get brought into the Korean War, we get brought into Vietnam, we get brought into post-Cold War conflicts with Indonesia because they have a communist leader in the 60s, and Vietnam, and now we're in Iraq, and we were in Afghanistan as well. And there's been a lot of criticism about that, that basically we're going there because Americans need troops and they're telling us to bring troops. It's nothing to do with us. That's how a lot of Australians feel. A lot of Australians, we have a prime minister at the moment who's one of George W. Bush's best friends. So, you know, there's some Australians who support the war in Iraq, but I would argue that the majority of them don't. It's considered irrelevant to us in a lot of ways. That changed a little bit after the Bali bombings, which were in October 2003, where Islamic terrorists bombed two nightclubs in Bali that were primarily Australian tourists, and 89 people died. I mean, nothing compared to the World Trade Center, but for Australia, that was really significant. So it shifted a little bit there, but the anti-Iraq war sentiment in Australia is pretty high.
We have a couple of callers here. We'll bring them into the conversation. We'll start here with someone on line number two, and right here. Hello.
Yeah, just in terms of the current, the Iraq war, I saw part of a documentary. I didn't quite get my facts, in terms of years, but there appears that maybe there was a cover-up I don't know what year, whether the previous year, there were 11, it was discovered that there were 11 suicides, and that the following year there were 22. The general question, how much, I know that the Vietnam War, that even 10 years after, or maybe even more, there were suicides. So is there any percentage there, or, how many?
Of suicides?
Yeah, in terms of as a result of war. In other words, after they come back, that kind of thing. Is there any statistics there of how many of these soldiers commit suicide after? This was actually the one that I saw the documentary for Iraq was why they were still there. I mean, they were sent back again and again and again and tried to make the point, but yet, and there were 22, but I'm not too sure what year that was, but how many after they've left service, it seems to me that there must be a fairly good percentage of them that commit suicide.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of there's been a lot of studies done on post-war suicide of veterans. It's very difficult to get sort of exact numbers because a lot of suicides are masked by motor vehicle accidents or drug overdoses and things like that. I'm not sure particularly about Iraq at the moment, and particularly since I don't think the current war in Iraq, we have any idea what's going to happen when it's over in terms of post-war trauma, and I think that's going to be quite significant for the American government to deal with. But I know certainly in terms of post-Second World War, there were fairly high numbers of suicides. I'm not sure about statistics, but I think in Australia, I think of ex-POWs, it was about 5% So that's pretty significant. But I think with Iraq, it's, I mean, the Australian, the Australian military and the American military are notorious for not releasing statistics about things like that while operations are going on. And you can understand why in terms of morale and things like that. But I don't think we'll actually really know until the war is over, for the current war anyway.
So in terms of the post-traumatic, do they figure maybe 20% or 30%? Does it, for the Vietnam War, was it maybe 20% or so afterward, that, or is that high?
For PTSD?
Right.
Yeah, it was between 20 and 30% for Australian and American veterans. And when they actually did the testing, there were people who had recently, who they did a comparison between people who had lifetime PTSD and people who had only recently developed it. But there's actually been new studies actually done this year that are trying to argue that those numbers are inflated. But, it's generally around 30%.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And to, we had another caller, and I guess they changed their mind. If somebody else wants to call, you can do that. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm sure that there are, for people who have tried to talk with veterans about their experiences, mm-hmm. it's difficult, even if the veterans are interested in trying to open up and to talk about what they went through, that I'm sure that there is always the feeling on their part, whether they articulate it or not, that because you weren't there,
yep.
there is no way that you're going to be able to understand. No matter what, I can talk to you all day about what
yep.
happened to me.
Absolutely.
And maybe you'll get a little bit of an idea, but that you weren't there, so you're just never going to know.
Yep. I get that a lot, especially being a woman, because they say, well, you can never get called up for service, which, may or may not be true in the future. But I think I was lucky at the point at which I was doing a lot of my interviews with ex-POWs, both in England and Australia. They're all in their 80s and 90s. They know their mortality is creeping up, and they really wanted to talk at that point. They were just happy to talk to someone, because a lot of them can't talk about it with their families. So they knew I would come in, I would get their stories, and then I'd go away. So I was very lucky. And I think also because I was younger, they saw me as sort of part of their grandchildren's generation, which is a much easier generation for them to talk to than their children, who have some experience of the war, whether having lived with them as parents or actually remembering it. So I think I was very lucky from that point of view. But there are particular problems with talking to veterans of any war about traumatic events. One is group loyalty, which is a big problem. I mean, it's not a problem. It's just, how it is. A lot of veterans are very, there's a saying that war brings out the best and the worst of every man. So they're very reluctant to criticize other people's behavior sometimes, because what if someone's going to criticize them? So that's one problem that, for example, with my research, there were, if they criticized a doctor, if I was talking to an ex-POW who criticized a doctor, he would never name him. So it was hard for me to get sort of corroborating evidence of an event or things like that. And, of course, trauma itself has a very significant effect on memory. I interviewed a doctor in Britain who said, I interviewed him one day and he said, I can't understand why everyone says that the Japanese beat up everyone. I was never touched. They never touched me. And I said, oh, that's interesting. That's pretty unusual for a doctor who were often beaten and tortured because they were blamed for the high rates of sick. So the next day I read his diary that he wrote at the time, and there was just a list of, every day getting beaten, broken jaws, concussion, things like that. So I went back to him the next day and I said, hey, what's this? And he just gave me the most brilliant answer. He said, oh, well, I guess I repressed it because that just makes it easier. Hmm. So you're dealing with that all the time as well. Plus it was, 60 years ago, and there's often the problem of when a lot of veterans only, and this is true for Vietnam as well, often only talk to each other. So they tend to take on a group memory, and they sometimes adopt other people's stories into their own schema. And they might recount an experience verbatim that they were never actually there. So that adds, difficult layers for all historians when there's very little corroborating evidence. But I think that, the silences and what they leave out and what they emphasize, I think is just as interesting and important you know, even though it's a very flawed methodology.
Yeah. Well, if you look at what it is they do emphasize, what it is the kinds of things that you would hear over and over again would be, what would that be? I mean, did it seem like that for a lot of them there was something that all of them had inside that they really needed to get out, that they were happy to have an opportunity to talk about?
Yep. I think, well, for the Australians in particular, it was about showing how they all looked after each other. It was very much, you know, we had a terrible time, lots of people were dying, but no one ever died alone. You know, we're always there for each other, we always looked after each other, and that was very important for them to emphasize. And, you know, that is and isn't borne out by research. I mean, there's a lot of people who died alone. There's a lot of people who weren't looked after. Not for any malicious reason, just everyone was starving and everyone was dying, you know. But the mateship is very much emphasized all the time. And also the humor they like to talk about, because, you know, when you don't want to talk about all the bad things the whole time. So in an interview, for instance, if things got a little bit too hard for them to talk about or they started to break down, they'd immediately switch to a joke. Well, did you hear the one about that Japanese guard that we played that trick on? You know, so humor was very much a defense as well. And they very much wanted to emphasize the strength of character of prisoners. And, you know, that they survived, and they survived the post-war era. And that their war experience is just as important as anybody else's who was in combat. And that's something that's been very hard for people to accept sometimes, because especially in talking about PTSD and trauma, a lot of psychiatrists or other veterans would say, but you were prisoners. You weren't shot at. You weren't in a war. You were just prisoners. You were passive. You were helpless. You know, it's completely different. And they'd say, but that's exactly why it was traumatizing. Plus they had a 30 to 40% mortality rate, so they weren't having a great time. But that sort of the feminized condition of captivity in some ways precluded them from being able to be traumatized for a long time.
You know, I'm sure that there is no way that you could help but have that kind of experience mark you and shape you for the rest of your life.
Yep.
And that there could be maybe two extreme sort of ways to deal with that. One would be to then ever after say to yourself and everybody else that everything that ever happened to you afterwards was somehow connected to that.
Yep.
The other extreme would be to say it has nothing to do. So either you could say it has everything to do with the rest of my life, or it has nothing to do with the rest of my life. And of course, could be a lot of places in between. But I wonder if of the two extremes, I mean, did you find a lot of people wanting to say, well, this really explains everything that happened to me afterwards?
In some ways, I think particularly once veterans or POWs retire, that's when they start to reflect, and that's when they start to be open to being interviewed. And for most POWs, this is ex-POWs and veterans, especially Second World War veterans, and Vietnam as well, this is the most significant period of their lives. This is where they test themselves. This is when they learn who they are. And of course, that whether they like it or not, that affects everything that happens after them. And just, you know, family relationships and things like that. I mean, the effect on the families is quite significant, and there's now a lot of research being done on the effect of veteran PTSD on families. Mm-hmm. But I don't think any of them would say that the experience didn't change them. And they all, one of their anxieties about talking about this story is that it is the most significant period of their lives to most of them. Just you know, for 3.5 years, I'm talking about POWs or World War II veterans in general, they had to survive. They had their mortality thrust in their face every single day. They saw their friends and comrades dying in horrific conditions. And so there are some common patterns among all ex-veterans. You know, a lot of them share sort of a basic appreciation of basic life values, you know, not being materialistic because they didn't have anything, and they learned not to rely on possessions. I've never seen a POW not clear as plate. You know, they're still so remember vividly starving for 3.5 years. They never waste food. You know, things like that that, mm-hmm. that never stop. And the things like the classic PTSD responses to certain stimuli, like Dr. Ian Duncan, one of my subjects, he, after the war, he was very much, well, that was that. I'm just going to get back to my career now. Everything's going to be fine. I don't feel traumatized. I'm fine. And then he noticed that when he watched baseball games, he would start sweating and he'd start shaking and he'd feel nauseated and he'd have to leave. And it wasn't until he was in his 70s when he started to allow memories of captivity to come back that he realized that the sound of a baseball bat hitting a ball was the same as seeing prisoners beaten to death with wooden sticks and the sound of the bones breaking. And so he had a classic PTSD reaction, but he didn't allow himself to feel that until decades later. So I think the effects are so obvious, but it depends on the individual allowing them to come forward or not. In terms of their significance on their post-war life, I think.
Mm. Let's talk with someone else here. We have someone in Longview, our line number one. Hello.
Yes, getting back to the earlier notion that more recent or veterans of more recent conflicts are viewed by those veterans of older conflicts as somehow being constitutionally weaker or something for reporting symptoms of PTSD and that sort of thing. One of my reservist friends recently made mention of having read some statistics that suggested that veterans of more recent conflicts have actually been exposed to far greater risk, if you will, in that for the days that the boots are on the ground, so to speak, the risk of actually facing combat is much, much higher than it was with older conflicts. It made a lot of sense to me, given the efficiency with which we transport troops these days and the ability to take logistical support to the troops at the front line and such. And I just wondered if you had any actual figures to attach to that concept.
I don't, but I think that's a really interesting point, and I think that's something I need to research because that makes sense to me.
Then I guess the other thing I would ask is just given the nature of combatants, I mean, particularly in our current conflict, as far as, perhaps not being able to identify somebody as a combatant, I would think even in a non-firefight situation, catecholamine levels that these soldiers must be experiencing because of the inability to separate potential combat situation from one that might or might not be realized is another factor that
of
might
course.
Explain an increasing frequency of PTSD.
Absolutely. I mean, the lack of a clear enemy is a real problem, and that was a real problem in Vietnam, of course, because civilians and Viet Cong were a lot of times indistinguishable. So everybody was a potential enemy, and particularly on peacekeeping operations, soldiers are shot at and are exposed to mines that are laid by civilians, and they can be attacked by children and things like that. So everyone on a peacekeeping mission, and usually peacekeepers are pretty unpopular. Nobody wants them there. A lot of the time, the government wants them there, but the civilians don't really. So they have this sense of imminent attack all the time, even though it's not meant to be a hot combat environment. So that is the fear and the apprehension, I think, is one of the main reasons for peacekeeper trauma. Yeah.
Thank you for your thoughts.
Right, thanks
for the call. One thing I want to just ask as a kind of an open-ended question is whether you think there are any the extent that you know the United States and have some sense about the experience of American veterans, whether there are any really interesting, significant differences between the Australian experience and the American experience. And I would think that there are ways in which Australia and the United States are not hugely different countries. Any really interesting, though, differences that emerge, do you think?
Well, I think one of the most significant differences is that we're such a small country. I mean, geographically we're huge, but we have a tiny population, so we're pretty insignificant in the world. And so veterans groups who are lobbying for better recognition of PTSD have a very small voice in the grand scheme of things. And I think the Australian Vietnam veteran campaigning very much came on the tails of the American. They saw what the Americans were doing and they said, hey, we've got problems too. Let's adopt that. But I think, I hate to resort to cultural stereotypes.
Oh, go ahead.
But I think Americans are very good at standing up for themselves. They're confident. They're taught to expect something if they think they deserve it. Australians are from a British culture. The British culture is stiff upper lip, just deal with it, don't complain, don't be a parasite on the government. So I think the culture of getting help in Australia is much more loaded than I think it is here. I think Americans are much better at asking for help when they need it and much better at campaigning, whereas Australians are very – it's taken a long time for veterans groups to actually say, hey, we need to be listened to. Because people basically say, well, you know, you had your experience, shut up and go home and drink if you need to, you know. So I think the cultural construct of acknowledging that you're having problems, especially mentally, which is so stigmatized, and then asking for help are quite different in Australia and America.
Yeah. Well, I think it's still in the United States, mental illness is a stigmatized condition. And
Absolutely. It's
not, you know, that makes it very difficult for someone who genuinely is having problems, going through a lot of emotional distress, maybe a lot of pain. It's not always a really easy thing to stand
sure.
up and say, hey, I'm having some problems here. I need to have some help.
Absolutely.
But it sounds as if you're saying that might even be more difficult in Australia.
I think so, yeah.
You know, I think one of the things that I think people in the United States are coming to think more about is the consequences for soldiers of the decision to send them somewhere mm-hmm. to fight, you know, and that maybe because we do have a discussion now of battle stress that maybe we didn't before.
Yep.
That maybe people are coming to more appreciate the fact that a soldier, man or woman, could go and could serve, could come back with no visible wounds and yet have psychological scars.
Yeah.
Things that are there as a result of the experience that you can't see.
Yep.
And that maybe people are starting to think more about at least raising this question and says, okay, you know, if you're going to make the decision to send soldiers someplace, you ought to consider the consequences
yeah.
for them.
You and
know,
you must
you
be
better
responsible
be pretty
for
sure.
It. Yeah.
And that, yes. And the other thing is that you also better be willing to take care of them when they come
exactly.
back.
Yeah.
Is that something that people talk about in Australia, particularly in terms of what the government does or doesn't do for veterans?
Absolutely. I think that happens everywhere. And Britain's a great example of how not to do it. They don't have any sort of PTSD facilities. PTSD is a dirty word. It's not talked about in the military. They don't have any sort of center of PTSD like they do in America and like they do in Australia. So any veterans that are suffering from trauma, I mean, for example, the Falklands War of 1982, when Britain went to war with Argentina, more Falklands War veterans committed suicide after the war than died in combat. So, I mean, the British system is so, so bad towards veterans that in comparison with them, I think Australia and America are doing pretty well, that they're admitting it. There are government institutions set up to deal with it, to study it. To develop protocols about stress management programs and embedded psychologists and things like that. So, I mean, it's taken a long time to get to this point, but I think it can only get better from here.
Yeah. I mean, certainly the involvement of Australia is not like the involvement of the United States. And if you look at the number of troops, for example, the number of troops we have that have been involved in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Yeah,
so I think that it's huge. And I think that there has been some justified concern raised about whether or not we have anywhere near the resources dedicated to dealing
sure.
with what potential problems we might have to. Same kind of concerns in Australia, even though I suppose we're talking about the numbers are much smaller.
Sure, but I mean, it's proportional. I mean, we're a very small military, so the numbers that are in Iraq right now and also on, I think, about 12 peacekeeping missions, we're stretched pretty thin. So for the majority of the military to be deployed, and then we're still going to have to deal with the post-war effects physically and mentally. So I think the problem when you send someone on a deployment is you have no idea what effect it's going to have on them. You know, and you know, you can talk about PTSD all you want, but still, we're talking about a minority of veterans, a minority. Most people adapt, they cope, they rely on their training to cope with it. So I hope that in both countries, proportionally, there are facilities. But of course, a lot of people fall through the cracks. A lot of people leave the services straight after a deployment and are never heard from again. And so there's no way of tracing them and seeing how they're doing. And so that's a big problem.
Yeah. Well, there we'll have to finish up with our thanks to our guest, Dr. Rosalind Herter. She is right at the moment here visiting the United States. She's on a Fulbright Fellowship in the Department of Medical History at University of Wisconsin-Madison. And her area is, she's an historian who's interested in history of medicine, got her PhD at University of Melbourne, writing about the experiences of doctors who were military doctors who were prisoners of war of the Japanese during World War II, and she's done a lot of work and writing and research on post-traumatic stress disorder and the experiences of soldiers and prisoners of war. She's here visiting. Her visit is sponsored by the folks in the Medical Humanities and Social Sciences program in the U of I College of Medicine. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.